Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, now celebrating their 125th anniversary. From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Have you ever had a cronut? New York City chef Dominique Ansel's invention married a donut with a croissant, spawning such a craze that Time magazine named it 2013's Invention of the Year. In Louisiana, Scott Roebuck of Shreveport's Serendipity Restaurant has mastered the art. There's also a lot of artisanal skill required in black pot cookery. We're heading to Lafayette's Black Pot Festival to learn from the best. And food writer Stanley Dry joins us to reflect on what makes Louisiana cooking so unique. We've got a great taste of the state from north to south on this week's Louisiana Eats. In Shreveport's historic Highland District, there's a charming little cafe called Serendipity. Not Serendipity, Serendipity. The unusual name honors the seven members who make up Liz Bowen and Scott Roebuck's blended family. Serendipity Cafe was originally founded in a small building downtown, where Scott and Liz served guests breakfast and lunch for several years, developing a strong following among the downtown community. But as demand grew, they had to expand to a larger space. Once established in the Highland neighborhood, they had to get the word out. So Scott got to work on a new item to add to the menu, his version of the cronut, but with a Louisiana twist.
It's spelled just like the crow in Louisiana, the C-R-E-A-U-X nut. So this is what we did. I baked a cronut, and I stuffed it with Nutella, cream cheese, and strawberries, and grade A maple syrup. And this is absolutely to die for. Yes. But if we didn't make it better than a cronut, we wouldn't be Serendipity. This is what we do. We will take a simple recipe, a traditional recipe, and then we'll take it and we'll make it our own. And that's what we did with the cronut, and we've just begun. We're making cronut sandwiches. We're just really broadening the horizon.
Their plan worked. Almost overnight, Serendipity became a destination for locals and tourists looking to try Scott's new pastry.
And so we got them ready, and we released them last weekend. Saturday, we sold 273 cronuts. Sunday, we sold over 100. Tuesday, we sold over 100. Just every day, it's growing. Between Saturday and Monday morning, we had 40,000 hits on our webpage. We had over 25,000 hits on our Facebook page. We had people driving in from Baton Rouge, Hot Springs, Arkansas, just everywhere. It's been really crazy, really, about where people are coming from. We had Annie Anderson came in and filmed with us for a couple hours the other day on the cronuts, and she's actually eaten at the New York establishment, and well, she really liked ours, so...
At this point, I have to give a disclaimer. When Shreveport's cronut craze was in full swing, Scott received a cease and desist order from the cronut originator, Chef Dominique Ansel, who owned the trademark on the name. After much deliberation and even a contest among Serendipity's customers, the Shreveport cronut is now simply called Steve. Well, Steve might not have the same ring to it as cronut. The time and labor required to make one is very much the same. Scott explains the baking technique, which he says takes 14 hours from start to finish.
It's a little complicated, and it's technical, and it's just a pain in the butt. It really is. So you start off, and you got your basic flour, milk, yeast, water, sugar, salt. Butter, you got to cube up the butter to its, you know, probably half by half by half. And so you take the flour, the salt, the sugar, and the butter, and then you got to stick it in a food processor to break down that butter a little bit, make it smaller. But you can't give the butter time to soften up, because if it softens up, it just saturates everything and it won't work. So you got to do it pretty quick, and then you got to stick it back in the cooler. Then you take it and you mix the the flour that's with the butter and the sugar and the salt, and you mix it with milk and warm water and yeast, and then you get your dough, and you can't really knead it like you would a normal bread or something like that, because again, you'll smush the butter. So you take it and you kind of gently baby it into, you know, just a small dough ball, and you wrap it with saran wrap, and it goes in a cooler for 2 hours so that butter can firm back up and the gluten can do its job and the yeast can do its job. Then you take it back out after 2 hours, and then you roll it out, and then you got to fold it a certain amount of time so you have 187 folds in it.
So it's a very similar to making puff pastry. It basically is a puff pastry process, ma'am, where you're getting those butter layers in there, where when they bake, they're going to puff, and that's what's going to give you.
That's what gives you your pockets. So you roll it out, and you fold it, and you stick it back in the cooler overnight, and then when you pull it out, you roll it back out, you cut out your donuts. And what makes them tricky is through the whole stage, it's all crucial that you do it quickly so you don't lose that butter and it don't soften up. But when you go to fry it, it's spongy, you know, like a croissant, you know, so you have to fry it at the exact right temperature at the exact right time, because if you leave it in there too long, it absorbs all that oil, then you just got a really nasty, soggy mess. And if you do it under that, then you got a doughy mess. And so it's very meticulous, and so you got to turn it and flip it, and as you're turning and flipping it, it's extremely brittle and extremely flaky. That's what makes it so good. So it's very delicate. So you'll turn it, and then sometimes it'll just poof and collapse, and so then you got to start the whole process over. But we got it down to a science now. It's timed, it's weighed, it's measured, so we can turn them out pretty fast now, and we're getting better and better each day, and as long as my guys are getting better at what they do every day, then you really can't ask for more.
With this level of expertise and success, you might be surprised to know that neither Scott nor Liz had any prior experience working in kitchens. When Scott moved to Shreveport, it was actually his background in IT that eventually led to the opening of Sevendipity.
You know, we have 5 kids, so that's where the name Sevendipity comes from. It has to support 7 of us. And when we found the downtown cafe, I was looking for an IT job, and the people selling it accidentally posted it in the wrong classified sections. And so we kind of laughed and joked about it. So that's kind of serendipity. We found it. So we went and looked at it, and for some strange reason, we said, man, let's do this. And then we bought it, and then we walked in the cafe after we bought it and thought, what did we do? You know, neither one of us know nothing about this. when we came across the cafe, we needed to purchase a lot of equipment, and you know, from not working, you know, we had no money, nothing, not a penny. And she came to me, and one night she said, can you do this? And I said, yeah, I can do it. And so she said okay, and she drove down to Lake Charles, and she begged and borrowed with her family, and borrowed $40,000 on my word that I could do it. And at that point right then, that I knew that I would, there was not an option of failing. And then I knew I was going to be I had to be the best I possibly could be.
How did you teach yourself all this?
Well, my background prior to us opening the restaurant was in IT. I was an IT engineer. I did that from the time I was 15 until we opened the cafe. And so my mind's kind of trained to troubleshoot and to you know, to take moving parts out of a mechanical device. And in IT, numbers is everything. So to me, a recipe is a mathematical equation. And so just in my background in engineering and really not knowing anything about food, I went and I searched and I found 5 recipes for each item. And her mom, which is my holy grail, gave me a Betty Crocker cookbook from the 30s. And it's fallen apart and it's taped up and it's jacked up. And I took the root of that and I found 5 other copies of recipes. And I broke them down mathematical and found the common denominator in each of them. Then I researched why that was the common denominator, and if there was something different, I went and researched that ingredient and found what it did to that dish, how it changed that dish, how what it added to that dish, and just kept breaking it down mathematically until I got it down to where I felt it was my own. And so that's how I started. We try to be as contemporary and traditional as you could be in the same time. And so That's, you know, that's kind of how the food kind of evolved, and we would trial and error until I got the right reaction from the consumer. The first bread I ever made, I watched YouTube, and that's how I learned how to make bread off YouTube. And then I took that old Betty Crocker cookbook and found an old bread recipe. Then I tweaked it, and I made bread and just kept making it. And I memorized how the dough should feel, how it should smell, how it should look, the consistency of it. I can tell, you know, I can walk in the kitchen and smell the bread in the oven and tell you how far along it is. You know, I can look at the bread and the dough in the mixer and tell you if they missed an ingredient. And that's what I teach all my staff is smell it, you know, touch it, feel it, you know that smell. When you walk by and you can look at when they're making something and you can smell that something's missing, you know, then you're honing in on your craft. And that's what we try to do. And we just try to make each other better and learn from each other, because no matter how much experience you have or how little experience you have, you can always learn something from somebody from somewhere. And as long as you're learning and just feeling yourself with that knowledge, then you're going to be successful, you know. And so that's what we strive. And the crazy mixtures of food we have is again from lack of experience, you know. Not, you know, they say you shouldn't mix this with this. Well, I didn't know that, so I mixed it, you know, and it worked. And so that's where a lot of that comes from. And you don't change something that's not broke. And so we're going to keep with that same trend, and we're going to keep growing, and we're going to keep making unique, weird stuff. And until they stop telling me they love it, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. And, you know, and my goal is eventually to be sitting on a beach somewhere with my beautiful, beautiful wife and having somebody else run our business, because that's what all this is for, is for my family. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but down the road, so my family can say, man, we started with not a penny, and now look where we're at. And it's a gift from the community, which has given us this opportunity, and we're not going to let that falter.
Scott Roebuck of Serendipity Cafe in Shreveport's historic Highland District. To learn more about the restaurant and his famous pastry, Steve, go to serendipitycafe.com. When we come back, we're heading to Lafayette for the annual Black Pot Festival. You don't want to miss this, so stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's.
I'm going down to Lafayette. I don't care how long I'm gone. It's so hard to leave you, Lafayette.
Cajun culture is cool these days. Over the past several decades, the folks of Southwest Louisiana have embraced their Acadian heritage in all sorts of ways, whether it's speaking the language, playing the music, or cooking the food. Maybe that's because as little as two generations ago, Cajun culture was under attack. Here's 78-year-old accordion maker Larry Miller of IOTA.
When I was a kid, we were kind of careful not to play our music in front of non-Cajun people, because you kind of felt like you were not so smart if you didn't speak, you know, standard American English. So we were kind of ashamed of our music and our culture until we outsiders began to tell us how much of a rich culture and an attractive music and an interesting lifestyle we had and that kind of thing. And the cooking has been one of the attractions, not just the music and dance, but the cooking has been one of the attractions.
Larry stood in front of the main stage and dance hall at the Black Pot Festival and Cook-Off in Lafayette. skies were clear on that October afternoon, and the smell of a nutty roux bubbled up from a black pot behind him. A cooking competition was underway, and later on that night, winners were victoriously crowned, once all the food was given away. But as producer Thomas Walsh learned over this mouth-watering weekend, the desire for community outweighed the competition.
I was smack dab in the middle of the Acadian village on a crisp Saturday morning as chefs from around southwestern Louisiana were setting up for that day's cook-off. The village? Well, it looks like a 19th century frontier, complete with bayou and shady oaks. It's the kind of place you visit in fourth grade. Now, the booths formed a perimeter around the fairgrounds, and every chef there had their own black pot. Here's Ryan Traha of Dark Root, a Lafayette-based restaurant.
Most people's pots are just as important to them as, I guess, say their wives are. Some of them really, really get married to their pots, and Big Lou that we were talking with the other night, he's had pots for 30 years, and he loves them, and he has pots that he uses for one specific thing only, and it's just all a matter of personal preference.
There were five categories in this competition: cracklings, jambalayas, gumbos, desserts, and gravies. That's any sort of sauce, like sauce piquante. Now, Ryan and his restaurant partner, Corey Bourgeois, had done their fair share of festival cooking, but this was their first black pot.
We borrowed this black pot from Curtis Louvier, who's very, very knowledgeable and has been doing this for years. And so I went over my game plan with him last night, and he was very, very helpful with just little tips here and there. And that's what I love about, like, the community we have, like, say, like, just being able to ask each other for advice. I ask Jeremy all the time. He's been doing this longer than I have. People like that are really good to be friends with because those weird little things that you ask questions about, they've probably done or not done.
The man Corey name-dropped is Jeremy Connor, a six-foot-something beast of a man who happened to be right next door to the Dark Root guys. As I approached him, he was staring deeply into his gumbo pot, transfixed on his roux.
This is one of the most fun parts of making a gumbo is when the roux is almost dark enough and you just get to smell it and play with it. This is the best part. Well, when you're cooking for a lot of people, this is the best way to make gumbo. When we make gumbo at the restaurant, we use aluminum and stainless steel cookware, but you know, in a situation like this where you want to prepare a large sort of rustic meal for a whole lot of people at once, this is the way to go, and you don't get these kind of results with any other way to cook.
That connection to black pots runs deep. When I first met John Vadrine, he remembers his grandmother's kitchen being an arsenal of black pots. One special pot for every special dish.
Black pots in our family are the treasures that we pass on. My son is going to inherit my pots. I inherited a couple of them, and in fact, I can remember it's like, when she, you know, I hated to see her pass, but you know, I can remember the family getting together and say, "So which pot do you want?" I want the sauce pot, you know, or I want the fry pot, and so I got the sauce pot.
Hey, mama. Now, as far as the competition was concerned, it didn't take long before I understood that it was a competition in the loosest sense of the word.
I've been coming for, let's see, like 6 years now, and I never know who the winner is.
Competitors pay a minimum $50 entrance fee and compete for a $150 cash prize. Now, even in a winning scenario, there's no way that the $100 spread could recoup their expenses. That goes double if you're living large, like J.D. Regard, who got there early to pass out free beignets and old fashions.
In the bar alone, I've got about $450 invested today. And we have a lot of people coming to Black Pot from all parts of the country. New York, just today, New York, Vermont, Wisconsin, Germany, France. It's amazing. And we love sharing. We brought lots of booze, lots of food. The folks that are giving it away don't get paid for this. You know, we're out here giving it away. But that's what makes this particular festival, I think, one of the most unique festivals in the state of Louisiana.
I've met a lot of different people, too. The night before, I had drinks with people from Maine and California. And then early that morning, I met a retired couple from Switzerland who were visiting Brobridge and moseyed on over here after reading about the festival in the paper.
We are surprised how happy the people are. And young and old is dancing and having a good time. That's the most important in life, huh?
We'll put herbs, but if you ask any of the locals, they'll tell you that that vibe isn't out of the ordinary.
It's just, it's very family oriented, not in the sense of, you know, fun jumps and things like that, but it's people who know each other and who have traditions and more or less a philosophy in common of doing things from the ground up. You know, these guys to the left of us, they're going to be making cracklins and beignets and sauce piquant and I don't know what all. And they do that every weekend for family. So it's just doing it in public. It's very normal. This is very normal for South Louisiana.
And as the square dance livened up, I went back over to go check in with Jeremy Connor and the guys from Dark Crew. When I ran into Jeremy, he had some news for me.
Well, I've heard they sold 4,000 tickets, and I'm not intending to come anywhere close to feeding all of them, but yeah, as many as we can get food in their mouths, that's what we're going to do.
Meanwhile, Ryan was preparing a backbone stew, and Corey was patiently stirring a roux to make sure it didn't stick to the bottom of the black pot. But both of them were really anticipating something else on the menu.
I think our dessert is going to be the one that catches most people's eyes. With Ryan made a chocolate ganache-filled donut that we're going to fry in our crackling grease, and then we're going to make a vanilla bean ice cream with our liquid nitrogen. The only rule is it has to be cooked in a black pot, so we're going to follow that.
More on that liquid nitrogen later. But as the midday sun began to rise, it was clear this cook-off was underway and I was just an extra hand in the kitchen. I figured I'd give square dancing a try and then head on back to my campsite. That morning had been a revelation. I'd learned that people treat their black pots with nothing short of dignity and pass them on as heirlooms. I also learned that the restaurant scene in Lafayette is a tightly knit community, and that kind of generous spirit catches fire. It's no wonder people come from all over to be a part of this. But outside influence is something that actually saved Cajun culture, at least according to 78-year-old accordion maker Larry Miller. He told me that when he was growing up in the 40s, Cajuns were chastised for celebrating their heritage.
So we were kind of ashamed of our music and our culture until we outsiders began to tell us how much of a rich culture and an attractive music and an interesting lifestyle we had and that kind of thing. And so they would come here and listen to the music and get into it almost like they sort of belong to, you know, to an identity that they didn't have. So those people began to make us realize that we had a rich culture that we shouldn't throw it away. So we were throwing it away for a while, and then we sort of came back on.
So all this dancing and cooking and hospitality that had won me and countless others over, we weren't the first to revel in it. No big shocker there, right? But Larry had contextualized the importance of Black Pot. Without the festival, tourists couldn't experience the culture, and locals, well, they couldn't share it with others either.
The end result is that this festival is known for sort of a giant hospitality element in there because for the last 3-4 hours people have been building around talking to our people here, and I know I've been noticing they're at every booth kind of meeting people and just kind of sizing up the food preparation and the cultural aspects of it. So that's why this little festival has been growing very fast.
Now at this point, hundreds of people now gathered between the booths, and the atmosphere was getting rambunctious. You could barely walk anywhere without being caught in the middle of something.
I thought about starting my own business, like a dirty 800 French phone number.
Backstage, the guys at Dark Crew were feeling the pressure of the clock, but they were keeping a cool head on their shoulders.
It's coming along very well. We had to kind of cut our roux time down and not get it as dark as we wanted because we were running out of time. But I'm really happy with everything right now. They're about to start getting frying chicken over there ready. We're going to top each bowl of gumbo with some fried chicken.
Before too long, the birds were ready and dinner was served.
Come on down, folks! Gumbo and fried Mexican!
Woo!
I'm talking about.
But the crew had one more trick up their sleeve.
Wait, you forgot about the ice cream, man.
I'm gonna go slower on this one. Too fast. You're burning me.
And I have no idea how they pulled this off. All I know is that by using traditional ingredients, a black pot, liquid nitrogen, yikes, and a hand blender that they had to lift above their shoulders, the guys at Dark Brew drew the biggest crowd I saw all day.
Now, you see all the air we got in this one?
Yep, I see you. I got you.
All right, who wants to lick it?
Pick me!
It tastes like you're eating pure cream. Like, it's so rich. Oh, my God. Yeah, you just stuck the beater out there, and it was like everybody was just getting a fingerful.
And as the food rolled out and twilight began to set in, there was only one thing left to do.
I feel like shots are in order now.
Let's do it.
Shots are in order. Let's do it.
Successful.
All right. Who wants some?
Before the night was over, the judges had made their selections and both Jeremy Connor and John Vadreen took home prizes. That night the dance floor was packed, but if there were any losers around, I didn't see them. For Louisiana Eats, I'm Thomas Walsh.
The Black Pot Festival is an annual event in Southwest Louisiana. To learn more about it, visit blackpotfestival.com. My friend Boo McComber is the genuine article. This Abbeville native has spent her life steeped in Cajun culture, and like many in Southwest Louisiana, Boo's number one talent is black pot cooking. Oh my, the delicious things I've tasted that come from Boo's old cast iron pots. My favorite, her dirty rice. You may have eaten dirty rice before, but trust me, you've never lived until you've had Boo's version. Dirty rice gets its name from dark bits of meat that are cooked with the rice, turning it all a dirty brown. When Boo makes her dirty rice, she starts off by making a roux. Okay, call me a city girl, but hers is the only dirty rice recipe I've ever seen that starts that way. In her black iron Dutch oven, Boo stirs together oil and flour until it's a dark chocolate brown, and then the onions are added, followed by celery and bell pepper. Meanwhile, in a separate skillet, she browns ground beef and sliced andouille sausage. I've never seen andouille in dirty rice before. Have you? When the meats are browned, she adds them to the roux and the seasonings with enough beef broth to make a thin gravy. She seasons the pot with bay leaves, garlic, parsley, green onions, and Worcestershire sauce. Then she simmers it for at least an hour, adding more broth if need be. Boo cooks her rice separately. Another odd variation, because usually the rice would cook with the meats and broth in order to absorb those flavors. But trust me, follow Boo's instructions, because when the rice is combined with that flavorful meat dressing, you've got something so good. Well, sometimes I could eat it till I'm sick. For a copy of Boo's recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com or at wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Boo McComber's dirty rice is some good Louisiana Eats. How do you properly care for that black iron cookware? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How do you care for that black iron cookware? The very first thing you must do is season it. Coat the piece all over with vegetable oil and bake it for an hour in a 350-degree oven. Now, the cooking can begin. The more you cook in a piece of cast iron, the better seasoned it will be. That's why Grandma's cast iron is such a treasured heirloom. When it's time to clean it, never soak it. Best to run hot water in the pan immediately, and anything that burned on, scrub with kosher salt or a non-metal brush. If you have to, occasionally use a few drops of mild liquid detergent. If the residue gets to be too sticky, or if it begins to rust, scrub it good with a wire brush and re-season just like before. Cooking in cast iron is even good for your health. The food absorbs some of the iron during the cooking process. The longer you simmer, the more beneficial iron you gain. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Journalist, public radio contributor, and author of Louisiana Rambles, Ian McNulty is always hunting down a new, obscure, but delicious spot for rambling. Ian, where are we rambling to today?
Well, Poppy, today we're taking a little trip to Lafayette to check out a place I just discovered recently, but has quickly grown near and dear to my heart and, more importantly, to my belly.
Oh, yes, and what is that?
Okay, this place is called Johnson's Boucanière. Now, boucanière, some people out there already know, I'm sure, is the Acadian word for smokehouse. And that is exactly what it is. This is basically Johnson's Smokehouse. And it's a traditional butcher shop smokehouse in Lafayette, working with these Cajun traditions. But it has a really interesting backstory to it. It's a fairly new place. It opened in 2008. But like a lot of interesting good things in Louisiana, its roots really go back a bit.
Really? How far?
So back to 1937, when a place called Johnson's Grocery opened up in Eunice, a great town for Cajun music, Cajun culture.
And Cajun meat.
And Cajun meat, absolutely. Well, Johnson's Grocery was a little dry goods place when it first opened, but it evolved over the generations into like one of the real go-to places in the Cajun prairie for boudin. Of course, our favorite rice and pork sausage there in the links. The Cajun breakfast, the Cajun lunch, the Cajun dinner, the Cajun snack, the Cajun everything, boudin. Well, sadly, to a lot of people, Johnson's Grocery closed in 2005 after, you know, a really long run of decades and decades and decades. But a few years later, another generation of the family just got the itch to get back into the business and really to reignite these old family recipes that were so popular there for so long. And they opened Johnson's Boucanière. Now, this is in Lafayette. It's not in Eunice. But if you were familiar with Johnson's Grocery's boudin and you taste what they're doing now at Johnson's Boucanière, same thing. It's same recipe, that same just really good snap to the link and just meaty links of boudin. They're peppery, but really more about savory seasoning than like spicy, spicy hot boudin. Really, to me, like one of the best links of boudin out there.
And what else do you get there besides boudin?
Well, this is a great place. I mean, the boucanière part, of course, the smokehouse, can mean a lot of different things in Cajun country. Here, in addition to boudin, it's really about barbecue, you know.
Barbecue?
This, yeah, it really functions as a Cajun barbecue restaurant. So you got a lot of smoked sausage there, of course, tasso, but also ribs and pork roasts and brisket, all just, you know, done with a little more spice and zing. Now, when you find this place, and I should say it's just on the edge of downtown Lafayette, just outside of the business district there, and not too far from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, it looks from the outside like a little grocery store, you know, and it's kind of packed inside with all sorts of clutter and stuff and little signs to read everywhere. And you can go in and get a pound of this or a pound of that. You can also eat in, and they have all kinds of sandwiches and plate lunches. And everyone eats kind of outside on this kind of wraparound patio deck that really kind of looks like more modern and contemporary. So it's sort of this interesting mashup of the old and the new at this place. And they're also, in addition to their food, they're really about music. They're really into promoting local music. You'll see CDs from local Cajun and Zydeco artists all over the walls, and that Lafayette roots music that's really coming back so strong. And you'll probably see a few musicians that you might recognize from the local festival circuit chowing down there as well.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So what are they eating, you know, besides the boudin? They have things like the Parent Special, which is basically their idea of a Cajun grilled cheese with a fried boudin ball smashed, covered in barbecue sauce, American cheese, all on an Evangeline-made bun. Evangeline-made being the kind of the big, like almost the big nostalgic kind of bread brand out there. And just really interesting sort of combinations of like smoked pulled chicken covered with smoked garlic pork sausage. I mean, just all these things all together on buns and on plates. The taste is really fabulous. Now, I'll mention it's mostly a lunch place, mostly about lunch or to pick up a feed to bring home, or in the case of our travelers out there, for the cooler, for something to bring back home to wherever you're traveling to. And they do close early on most nights, 6 o'clock. Better stay open a little bit later on the weekends if you're going to make a fun weekend of it out there in Lafayette.
Can you buy like a whole chicken? Or?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. When you go in, you'll see some people who are just there for lunch and others who are obviously stocking up for a big feed at home. So really what we have here, Johnson's Boucanière, it's a modern reengineering of a really old traditional Cajun country smokehouse with a long tradition to it. You see this in a lot of places, you know, and a lot all over the country, really. It's a trend. But when it happens in South Louisiana, it's going to be really fun and delicious.
Well, you have made me some hungry. Let's go.
Okay. I'm right behind you.
Okay. You ready to ramble?
Yeah, let's ramble on.
Thank you, Ian. Louisiana Eats ramblin' reporter Ian McNulty. As a writer for Food & Wine magazine, food editor of Louisiana Life magazine, and a member of the Southern Foodways Alliance, it seems natural that Stanley Dry's latest book is called The Essential Louisiana Cookbook. We all know Louisiana's culinary identity is a complex tapestry of French, Spanish, African, and Native American cultures. But Stanley's latest collection of recipes not only honors that diversity, it investigates the stories behind those dishes. The Essential Louisiana Cookbook features traditional recipes like crawfish etouffee, sauce piquante, and red beans and rice. But when Stanley sat down to speak with us, his appetite was focused on roux, rice, and gumbo.
Well, roux is so important to Louisiana cooking, and it sounds like a fairly simple thing because it's just flour that's cooked in oil. And certainly it has its roots in French cooking, where roux is used in so many dishes. But to make it without burning it is a whole other thing. I certainly burned my share, and if you take your eye off it for an instant, you can burn it. Or if you let it go a little too far, you can burn it. And then you throw the whole thing out because there's no resurrecting a burned roux.
There's nothing as tragic as if you've used that precious oil. If you've written the Essential Louisiana Cookbook, what is the most essential thing in Louisiana cooking?
Well, a roux would be right up there at the top, wouldn't it? I mean, you've got to have it for a lot of things, for a lot of things. The discussion last night was about different kinds of roux and then also about bottled and prepared roux, you know. My feeling is that the prepared roux are very good. And from what I've seen, an awful lot of people use them. They're widely, widely used. And for an awful lot of people, they just are looking for ways to cut down the time that they spend cooking. And I think the prepared roux are certainly acceptable. And when people used to have cooks and the cooks cooked every day, and they, for the most part, they didn't make a roux every time they started a dish. They would make up a pot of roux that would be enough to last them for a week or so, and then they would have it ready whenever they were doing the dishes. Restaurant chefs, the same thing. They don't start from scratch and make a roux each time. They make a big pot of roux and have it ready, and then the roux is ready when they use it. Now, I think if you are lucky enough to have a special kind of fat, you know, if you're lucky enough to have some duck fat or even some bacon grease, you know, you can make something that's different from what you're going to get in the bottle. But if you're going to use some vegetable oil and some flour, I think it's comes out about the same.
Well, let me ask you this. I think people are using more roux in the jar, it seems to me, in Southwest Louisiana than they are over here in the city. And one of the differences that I see in the use of the roux is if you've got that already made roux, you add the roux to the liquid.
Right.
And virtually everything I cook, I add the liquid to the roux.
Right. It does. It changes the order of things that you're doing. And from what I understand, restaurant chefs who make up big batches of roux, they've got the same situation. They're not doing it in the classic traditional way. I mean, I don't think it's a problem. I mean, I think you come out with the same result, but it just involves doing it in a different order. That's interesting what you said about people in Southwest Louisiana using the bottle roux more than they are here. But I think in general, the cooks in Southwest Louisiana tend to use more roux than people in New Orleans use. That's my impression. I don't have anything to back that up. But you know, some of the gumbos that people make are really, really thick with roux.
What is your favorite dish in the whole book? What's your favorite thing?
Oh, my favorite dish in the whole book? Oh, probably one of the gumbos. Gumbo's one of my favorite dishes, if not my favorite dish of anything, really. Just to see it and smell it cooking is great. I've always found when I'm learning to make something, I don't want to read just one cook's explanation of it. I want to read three or four or five or six, because none of them are going to be the same. They're all going to be different. And you learn so much more by comparing what different people do. If you do that, you can kind of develop your own personal style and approach to it. So that's just the way that I learned. And also, I mean, you continue learning, I think, and watching other people doing it, you pick up things that you didn't know before. You know, even recipes that I've published, when I make them again, even after they've been published, I keep working on them and changing them. And, you know, it's never finished. You're always trying to make it better, right?
That's right.
And that's what makes it so interesting, so much fun.
What's your favorite pot to make a roux in?
A black cast iron skillet, you know. I mean, it's not a family heirloom, but I've had it for a good while. I've had it for a good while, yeah. I remember one guy telling me, he said, sometimes when I'm in a hurry, I'll make my roux in the microwave. He said, but you know, I just don't feel right about it. And I do think that for making a roux, and this is true for a lot of different things, even if you're mostly going to buy the roux in a jar and use that, you still should learn how to do it. And from time to time, it makes sense to do it, because it puts you closer with the ingredients. It's like anything in cooking, I think. I used to be, I mean, when I was younger, I was an absolute purist. I mean, I wouldn't use an electric mixer to whip cream, you know, because I felt like whipped cream was better if you used a whisk. And maybe it is, I don't know, but now I use a mixer. I used to not own any electrical small appliances, you know. I've outgrown some of those things.
What do you think the most challenging thing in cooking Louisiana food is, maybe besides the roux?
Well, that's a good question.
I guess it's not fair, because it probably is the roux.
Well, I think getting the flavors right, because, you know, the combination of flavors and the amount of things that you put in there because oftentimes if you get away from Louisiana and you go to restaurants that have Louisiana food, things are just not quite right. Louisiana food got a reputation as being just fiery hot with pepper, and that's what a lot of people think that Louisiana food is, you know. Well, it always comes up, of course, you know, people bring up the question of what's the difference between Cajun and Creole cooking and all of that. Before Paul Prudhomme opened K. Paul's in the late 70s, 79, I think it was around then, you really didn't see Cajun food in New Orleans, to my memory.
You're absolutely right. And honestly, Paul's food wasn't really Cajun food. It was really a fusion.
Right. It was his own personal style of Cajun cooking. And he does come from Opelousas, where they do use a lot of pepper. So I think some of the distinctions kind of have gotten blurred over the last 30 or 40 years, you know.
I think it's confusion.
I think you're right.
It's the fusion that caused the great confusion.
I think you're right.
Because they're really two different kinds of things, and I think that people should respect that difference. What's the most unusual gumbo you've ever had?
I've judged at the gumbo cook-off in New Iberia for a number of years. And they have different categories. They have one category that is called mélange.
Okay.
You don't know what's in there. They can put anything in it. Then with some of my friends who hunt, I've had some interesting gumbos, you know, with duck and partridge and dove and, you know, all kinds of things in there. There's one gumbo that that I make from time to time. It's the only one that I make that I don't generally eat with rice, and that's a dried shrimp and egg gumbo.
Mm.
But you know what's interesting? Louisiana didn't really become a big rice-producing state until the late 19th century, mm-hmm. when a lot of Midwesterners came down and started out in southwest Louisiana raising rice. Before then, there was rice production in Louisiana, but it was a more occasional kind of thing. Sometimes they called it Providence rice because it depended on the rainfall rather than they weren't irrigating it. Mm-hmm. And there was a travel book written by a man named Robin. I think it was R.R. Robin. I'm not mm-hmm. sure. You're familiar with that? He traveled in Louisiana, I think it was about 1803, 1804, 1805. And he said in the travel book that when he was served gumbo, it wasn't served with rice. It was served with a cornmeal mush.
Mm. Now that I didn't know.
And an interesting thing with that, my ear, nose, and throat doctor, he hunts all over the world. And he was on a safari in Africa, I forget which country, and they had shot some small birds. And he taught the camp cooks how to make gumbo. They didn't know anything about gumbo, but he taught them how to make gumbo. They didn't have any rice in the camp, so what did they serve it with? A cornmeal mush. Isn't that interesting?
That's fascinating. How does gumbo get its name?
Well, I'm not sure that we can really say for sure. Don't you think? I mean, gumbo was the word for okra, wasn't it?
Yeah, king gumbo.
Yeah. I don't know. I think there's some other theories on it also.
Well, I wanted to see if you had a theory on it because it's one of my favorite things to say, and we'll never know for sure.
We'll never know.
Unless we learn how to time travel.
Right.
Author Stanley Dry on roux, rice, and gumbo. His latest book is The Essential Louisiana Cookbook, available from your independent bookstore.
And dry, well, I'm up here with no warning. And dry, well, I couldn't get a word in.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Dickie Brennan and Company. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to managing producer Thomas Walsh and associate producer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.